Okay, hello everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7, Exposing Digital Photography. So I figure we'll just dive right into it and talk about some of the administrative stuff a little bit later. Last year we offered this course for the first time, and I was going through my slides from that year, and I came across this slide, and I was trying to figure out what on earth I put a block of cheese when talking about cameras. And so it finally occurred to me that at the same time last year, I was talking about pinhole cameras, and in fact, I'm going to take a pinhole shot of all of you, and the whole point of it, I finally came to realize, is that all of you should say cheese. So say cheese, because we are actually going to be taking a photo of you. Oh, I need to time this. But don't worry, if your hair is slightly messed up, or if you don't think you look your best, because I guarantee that this shot will be really, really blurry. It will be probably the worst shot you have ever seen in your life. And sort of ironic, since this is, as you know, a digital photography class. But the point isn't so much that it's a horrible photo. The point is what kind of a photo it is that we are taking. Yes, it is digital, as you can probably recognize. This is, well, it's a camera, obviously. It's a digital camera, specifically. And in front of it, instead of having a lens, and I have a variety of lenses here, I have instead a cap that's been modified slightly. So this is the cap's before shot. Drilled a hole through the center of it, put some tape and aluminum foil on top of it, and just with the needle, the tiniest needle that I could find, just put a little tiny hole in the center. And then this way, light is entering into the camera and it is capturing a photo. So this is pretty high tech because it's actually a digital photo, and so we'll be able to see the results pretty soon, though I most likely won't show you the photo until next week to get you all to come back. Anyway, you can actually make a pinhole camera out of just about everything. Not only does it work with digital cameras, but it works with film cameras as well. And I would say that it's even more fun to make your own pinhole camera out of nothing but maybe a cardboard box that's pretty well sealed, and this aluminum foil trick with a little hole in the middle using a needle, and some film in the very back. And in fact, just to prove that you can make this sort of thing out of nothing, there is this website. And just about everything that I show you, I hope to post on as links on the course's website. So do feel free to take a look in more detail later on as well. And anyway, this person had actually created a pinhole camera out of Legos. And you can see that he went into quite a bit of detail about how to wind the film with the various bits of Legos, so on and so forth. And so one of the things that will be different this year over last year is that obviously everyone's talking about the economy. So how can we keep you all in this course while not making photography break the bank? And so hopefully we'll try to make some cheap photography tips along the way that can help you increase your fun with photography while decreasing decreasing the weight in your wallet, but that's exactly the opposite of what I meant. So the opposite of that, increasing the weight of your wallet. Okay, so let's take a step back again. So I talked about what this is in front of the camera. But now let's talk about some of these cameras themselves. And so the type of camera that is right here is an SLR, or single lens reflex camera. These comes in two varieties, digital and film, but most of you probably know that, and I'm sure all of you at least recognize the type of camera that it is. And what's great about these types of cameras is that you can change the lenses on them. That's probably the most recognizable feature of them, is that you can take one lens off, like this one, and put another lens on. So you can go from discrete camera to something that everybody is suddenly very afraid of, very, very easily. Now, there's a lot of differences between SLRs and other cameras, and we will certainly be talking about them in great detail over the course of this class. But don't worry too much about rushing out and buying an SLR just because you're interested in photography and just because this is a class about photography. You will find that you can take wonderful photos even with the camera that you already have. I always say that, but the thing is that it is a tool, and so the best tool that you have for the job is generally going to be a better option. And it really depends on not only your skill set, but also the money that you want to spend on it, and many, many factors that we will, of course, get into great detail. So Other general features about these is that they are bigger, obviously. They're much bigger. You can't just put this into your pocket as you can with many other cameras. They're much more expensive. New cameras these days range from, new SLRs range from just under $1,000 up to $8,000, $9,000, and much, much more than that. They also have a greater battery life than their smaller brethren, and that comes across for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that when you're looking through the viewfinder of a camera such as this, you are not actually using any energy in the camera, whereas with a typical digital camera that you're holding in front of your face, it's using a lot of energy to display the screen and the image that that shows on the screen. So that's just one reason, but there are other reasons that the SLRs have better battery life. So also, you'll generally find that they look more professional. So we can quit our photograph here. I'm going to take a peek. I'm going to say, you guys look terrible. Okay. So not only do they look more professional, it's because they are. They're generally stronger because they have metal bodies inside, and they're usually more, not more practical, but more durable. Usually they have some form of water resistance, and this has been in white water rafting, and I've dropped it onto rocks and all sorts of things, and it looks good as new. It still takes photos as great as the day that I bought it. Of course, one of the big things that will come up undoubtedly throughout this course is this large Canon versus Nikon debate. And so I don't want to devolve into anything like that, but generally you'll find that I use Canon, but that's just because when I bought an SLR, it ended up being a Canon, and so I sort of got locked into that system. Just like many of you who I'm sure bought your first SLR, you started buying lenses for it, and then you realize that, well, it's just not worth it to reinvest in many other lenses, and you just stick with one particular brand. And so it is what it is, and really I would have to say that for a while Nikon was not up to speed with digital, but now they seem to have, they really are giving Canon a run for their money, and so you really can't go wrong with either of them, and even some other fairly well-known camera manufacturers that are out there. But we will try to point out differences where we can, but like I said, since I'm a Canon guy, most of the stuff that I talk about, if it's specific to a camera, will be to Canon. But certainly feel free to interject if you know the Nikon system and say, oh, that feature is blank on Nikon, or that feature is blank on the Sony system, for example. So basically there's SLRs and then there's everything else. We could further divide these sorts of cameras down into subcategories, into camera phones and compact cameras and SLR-like compact cameras, et cetera, but it's really not useful for what we want to talk about. Generally, these have fixed lenses, which means that when you buy the camera, you have a lens on it. You can't upgrade the lens. You have to upgrade the entire thing. And it has all of the various downsides associated with them. So they have the shorter battery life than the SLRs. They're generally slower, variety of other things. However, one thing that's great about these is that they're small. You can take them anywhere, so they're discreet. You can take them, you can take one into, you can put it in your pocket, you can take it into areas where you really can't take an SLR, just because an SLR is so much bigger and people generally seem to be somewhat afraid of them these days, and increasingly so. So I really don't want to discourage small cameras. If you have a small camera right now, keep using it. Don't worry about buying a new camera right away if you're considering buying one. Especially don't consider buying one just for this course, because it's not necessarily a small camera that makes the photo interesting, or it's not necessarily a large camera that will make a photo interesting. And in fact, here, let's see, I have a link. This is from a blog post called Faces from Lesotho, where some group actually gave some folks in a village in Africa the small one-time use cameras that you can buy from CVS or Walgreens and the like, and asked them to just document their lives as they went through their day-to-day life. And I would argue that these are some of the most interesting photographs that I've ever seen. Even though they have no photographic experience at all, what they're able to capture is something that we just are not able to see. So I'll just scroll through some of them here. So obviously they have some sort of an agricultural system. You can see them cleaning here. They're making some food over a fire, various other things. So sure, we could nitpick and say, oh, you know, this is not exposed properly, and this is not It's not the most interesting composition we've ever seen, but that's not necessarily what they were going for. In this class, however, you'll find that a lot of the photographs that you take initially are supposed to be more technically based. So we are going to look at exposure and at not so much composition, because that's more the artistic side, but at the technical side of it, to make sure that you understand how to use it, so that when you're in a situation where you can take an interesting photo, you don't have to worry about what settings to use on your camera, what your camera will do, how it will react in certain situations. Okay. So let's go back to SLRs a little bit. And this is a diagram of how an SLR generally works. And so item number one here is a lens. And so you'll notice that it looks like there's a few pieces of glass, and indeed all lenses are composed of multiple units of glass, and generally not just one unit of glass. And so then number two is a mirror that exists inside of it. And so, let's see, I hope I will be able to show this to you. I'm going to take my camera off and try to, using this fancy technology called a webcam, try to display it on the screen. This is going to be embarrassing because I'm going to show up, and even though I know you can all see me, there's something very strange about looking at yourself. Okay, now I hope there's enough light, but let's see if we can... There's not enough light. Yeah, I was just going to try that, but I don't think that's going to be enough either. Nope. One more thing I'll try. Let me just turn on the lights. Let's try that again. That's worse. Okay. No. So you can sort of see it. Do you see right in the middle, there's a black box, and right here there is the mirror. And so that's a mirror that exists within the camera. So I'll probably pass this around in just a few minutes so you can take a look at it. And the way what happens here is that the light that enters through the lens bounces off the mirror and up into this pentaprism. Well, there's a variety of other prisms that they can use, but good cameras will use, or very fancy cameras will use, pentaprisms. They reflect the light around until eventually it reaches the eyepiece. So rather than using a typical digital camera where you hold up in front of your face to look at the screen, you look through the eyepiece to try to figure out how to frame and where to point the lens, basically. So I apologize if this is review to some of you, but many of you may not have seen the insides of this, and so I just want to make sure that everyone is brought up to speed first. Okay, so what happens when you take a photo? When you take a photo, it raises the mirror. That clicking sound is the mirror swinging up. So number two, do you see the arrow that swings up towards number five, the pentaprism? The mirror swings up, and the light is exposed to the sensor in the back, or the film in the back. There are a few more steps than this. Specifically, there's, especially in film, in all cases, there's a shutter that has to open and close. But the basic idea is that the mirror flips up so that the light can hit the film or hit the sensor, and it becomes digitized and becomes a photo. Okay, so what are some of these pieces here? So one is a lens. Two is the reflex mirror, and it's called the reflex because it's what happens. It moves up when you hit the shutter. We have the focal plane shutter number three, which is what I was talking about before. So not only does the film plane move up and out of the way, but the shutter has to open so that the light reaches the sensor for a specific amount of time. So when the mirror goes up and back down, it can't do it fast enough for a lot of these shutter speeds. So sometimes we're talking about shutter speeds of 1/1000th of a second, 1/2000th of a second. The mirror can't move up and down quick enough to prevent the light from hitting the sensor except for that small amount of time. So there's a shutter that has to do that work for us. So the mirror flips up out of the way. The shutter opens for however length of time you set or the camera is expected to do it. The shutter closes. The mirror comes back down. So there's an additional part here as well that is not really visible, especially in modern cameras and in modern SLRs and digital SLRs. There's another smaller mirror right here at a that's basically perpendicular to this larger reflex mirror. And what this does is it reflects some of the light. So this mirror number two doesn't reflect 100% of the light that comes in. It reflects only part of it, maybe 90%, 80%. Then the remaining light will fall on that other mirror and be bounced down into the body of the camera. In the body, there's some sensors, and that's what's used to detect how fast it should, all the settings that it should use, how fast it should make the shutter speed, the ISO, all of these various other things. So when your camera's telling you some values to use, it is because of that light that's being bounced off of that smaller mirror. Any questions? Okay, so this is really what gives the SLR its distinctive form. That's why all SLRs are essentially look the same. Even across Nikon, Canon, all of these various manufacturers, it's because all of these work essentially the same way. The light has to come in and up into the eyepiece. So there's another fancy feature that some of you may not have realized, and that is that almost all of these SLRs have what's called a diopter. And it's a small little gear that's in the upper right-hand corner, at least on this camera, it's on the upper right-hand corner of the eyepiece, and you can adjust it. So if you wear glasses and your eyesight is less than 20/20 or more than 20/20, you can usually adjust it so that you can look through the camera and you will be able to see sharply without needing your glasses to be able to do it. And this is especially an annoyance. I'm wearing contacts right now, but normally I wear glasses. And I know that pushing up this eyepiece right up against your glasses is one of the most annoying things in the world. It can really be a pain. However, some of us, like me, my prescription is actually so bad that no matter what I set the diopter to, I can't see it. So I just wear contacts and I'm done with it. But anyway, if that helps you, then I certainly hope it does. Okay, so.
Could you say what 5, 6, and 8 are?
Sure, so let's see. 5 is the focusing screen. So when you're looking through, especially the older film cameras, and you saw like a little circle in the middle, that's what you were looking at right there. 6 is what's called a condenser lens, and it's probably used, I don't have specifics there, but I would guess that it's used to help focus the light before it enters the pentaprism 7. And then 8 is the eyepiece. So that's the little lens that is right here. Okay. So you'll notice that just about every SLR has a fancy little icon right here. And I know you can't see it, so I will highlight it here. And it is this circle with a line through it. So notice that this is a circle with the vertical line through it and not a circle with a diagonal line through it. That the latter one, the circle with the diagonal line, means null or various other things. But this means film plane. Oh, sorry. Let me turn down the lights here a little bit. Is that better? Okay, apologies for that. I forgot to reset it. Okay, and so what this means, this symbol is telling you that along that plane, so if you imagine that line creates a plane that goes through the camera, so it's right here on my camera, and I know it's going right through here, that is exactly where the sensor or the film is on your camera. So if I go back here, then that means that circle with a line through it, that film plane indicator, tells you exactly where number 4 is in your camera. Now, this may seem sort of as a novelty at first, but it's going to become very, very useful when we start talking about focal lengths and start doing some calculations with aperture, because then you'll start to realize some of the power of knowing exactly how far it is between that film plane and the end of or the beginning of the lens mount right here. And by the way, in most cameras, in most 35-millimeter cameras, that's actually going to be 50 millimeters. So for those of you that are familiar with cameras and know that 50 millimeters are known, 50 millimeter lenses are known as normal lenses, you can sort of guess that there is a correlation between the two. So you'll typically only find this on SLRs, this film plane indicator, and it's because it's really not useful to know on any other sort of camera. We really don't care where the film plane is in a digital or a compact camera or in a camera phone because we can't change the lens, so there's really no reason for us to have to alter or do any calculations that might be useful with the location of the plane. So keep this in mind. We'll be referencing this symbol surprisingly frequently throughout the course. Okay, so I wanted to show some other things really quick, and that's this sort of internal breakdown of the camera. And so you can see here, this is of a Canon 40D. They now have newer models available, but the principles are essentially the same. You can see the larger mirror here and the smaller mirror that reflects the light down into the sensors behind it, the pentaprism up above, the various lenses in between it, and some of the mechanics behind it. Well, you can see the battery here, the shutter button up at the top, some of the electronics over here that make up the system itself. This actually, I shamelessly stole this image from a website called dpreview.com, dpreview.com. I always think of it as dpreview for some reason. Digitalphotographyreview.com, where they review in great detail digital cameras and various other things. So I'm sure that many of you looking for digital cameras have run across it, but hopefully now, as you go through this course, a lot of the stuff that they're talking about will make a lot more sense. Okay. But something else I wanted to mention about this is, what do you think would happen? What do you think is happening to my camera right now because I don't have a lens on it? And if I continue opening the shutter and raising the mirror, what am I doing to the sensor?
Dusty.
Yeah, I'm getting dusty. So I'm opening it to the outside world. And this is one of the biggest downsides, in my opinion, about SLRs compared to compact cameras, where compact cameras, where you cannot change the lens, there is really no chance for you to get dust inside of the lens mechanism or onto the sensor itself. But whenever you have a camera such as this, where you can actually move, you can actually expose the sensor to the elements, then you will get dust. There's some other things that happen to it as well. And so not only do we get dust in it, but we also, as we put the lens on the mount, we are scraping a little bit of plastic and metal up against each other, so we get small shavings of plastic and metal inside the camera, and that's, I think, primarily what the dust that you see is. And so for those of you that are not sure what I'm talking about, let me show you first an image. And so this is just an image. Yay, very nice. Now let me show you the original image. There are two dust specks. Well, there's more than that, but there's two noticeable ones. There's one here, and there's one here. So I'll flip back and forth, no dust, dust. And you can see that it gets really, really annoying. When you start realizing that your sensor has some dust on it, you have to clean it in order to get all of the dust off. And in fact, as I was testing this this setup with the pinhole lens that I made just earlier, I noticed that I had an incredible amount of dust in it. Okay, 1 second. So like I was saying, when I was testing this pinhole lens, I noticed that I had a lot of dust on the sensor and I had to clean it. And so last year I made the mistake of not demonstrating how to clean it, and that was a mistake on my part. But realized that there are many ways to actually clean a sensor on an SLR. And so what I have here is a small brush made from a company called Sensor Brush. And I think they've moved on to other products now, but I really like this because it's really just a very simple brush. Now, you could ask, well, it looks just like a paintbrush. Why don't you go to Home Depot and buy one of those? The reason is that they claim that they make the bristles on their brush much more finely. They're much finer than the bristles on a paintbrush. They're also made with a different material so that they don't come off of the brush as easily as a paintbrush. You think dust is bad, you really don't want paintbrush bristles inside of your camera, scratching your lens and scratching the insides of your camera. Bad news. So, and the other thing is that it is able to be negatively charged, I believe. So these bristles can have a slight static charge to them, so as you run them across the sensor, you can actually pick up some dust. So the general way to do this, and many people would argue that the best way is to use some sort of a liquid product. I don't know about you, but I really don't feel comfortable putting liquid on the inside of my camera. I'm sure that it is safe, especially if you use some specialized product for it, but I just feel a lot better using this dry method. And they now have bigger sensor brushes, ones that are wider that can accommodate the actual size of the sensor, but the general way to do it is that you get the brush out and use an air can. So this is compressed air, but you don't want the compressed air to be ejecting anything. And some compressed air cans, especially when they're low, they'll start ejecting some small amounts of liquid. You really don't want that because you're sort of ruining the whole point. So you just spray your bristles a bit, and now they're supposedly statically charged. And almost all SLRs now have this feature called a sensor clean. And so I've selected it on the menu here. You'll have to find in your on your digital camera how to go ahead and do this. And once you select it, it gives you a warning. You can see that the mirror has flipped up, and it's being held open, as is the shutter. So now what most of you, or at least some of you in the front rows, can see is the sensor directly. And you can see that in this camera, it looks kind of small, but trust me, as far as digital sensors go, this is relatively large. And you just use your charged brush and brush across the sensor. What I tend to do is horizontal. So I go across the sensor horizontally and then go across it vertically, test it to see if I have any dust left over, and we'll repeat. I usually have to do it maybe twice in order to get everything. So there's a variety of ways to do this. Don't take this as gospel or as being the only way to do it. But this way I've done for many, many years and have successfully cleaned my sensor without really worrying about the dust or damaging it. And this, the only complaint I have about this brush is that they give you a little plastic protector, and it never fits over the bristles just right. So the thing about cleaning that takes the longest amount of time is me sitting there trying to get the brush into the little plastic protector without bending. And I don't know, you probably can't see it, but there's like a couple bristles that I bent, and it really annoys me to no end. Yes?
To check if you still have dust, do you take a picture of a white wall?
Yes. So to test if you have dust on the sensor, you put on a lens on your camera, and you put the aperture, the F number, to be the highest value as that you possibly can. So let's see, on this one, on my 50 millimeter lens, it seems to be F22. So I do that. Point it towards a white wall or towards a light bulb, usually, because you'll need a good amount of light, and take a photo. And the best photo is the one where it's most of it is very, very white or very, very bright. And the increased F number, or the increased aperture, it's actually a decrease in aperture, and we'll go over all of this later, actually will expose the dust. That's the best way to expose the dust. So in this case, where you can see some of the dust here, it's possible in some cases to actually decrease the F number and make the dust disappear. That doesn't mean that it's gone. You've just made it disappear. And we'll go over why this happens in technical reasons a little bit later. Yes?
My camera claims it has a clear filter over the sensor. When you turn the power of the camera on, it shakes off dust.
Right. So so most of the modern cameras do have some sort of anti-dust feature. And I really should correct myself when I'm talking about the sensor, or that you can see the sensor directly. It's almost never the sensor directly that we're looking at. There's usually a few layers of protection, some filters in front of it. But still, we can think of the whole unit as a sensor. And usually these modern cameras, and I actually have a video of some of this stuff, which is pretty cool, is that they claim to have this sort of ultrasonic dust remover thing, doohickey, where the sensor unit shakes at some very high speed, and the idea is that the dust shakes off. I'm sure that this might work for most of the dust, but I can't imagine. All you're doing is just moving the dust elsewhere, so you're probably going to get the dust back on the sensor eventually anyway. So I have this video. Let me make sure that the sound works. Okay.
Dust adhering to the sensor of a digital SLR camera may have entered the camera from outside during lens replacement, or it may have been generated inside the camera. When dust adheres to the filter on the front surface of the sensor unit, its shadow appears on the photo. Canon's digital SLR camera is equipped with one of three types of imaging sensor, APS-C, APS-H, or 35mm full-frame size. Canon has developed a comprehensive system to eliminate the problem of sensor dust for each type of EOS sensor. The solution is the innovative EOS integrated cleaning system. First, the system prevents the generation of dust. Canon uses various mechanisms and materials to prevent the generation of dust inside the camera. Second, the system prevents the adhesion of dust. The filter incorporates anti-static properties, preventing dust from adhering to the sensor unit due to static electricity. And third, the system removes dust that still adheres. To deal with dust that adheres despite these measures, Canon developed the self-cleaning sensor unit. Ultrasonic waves vibrate the filter on the front of the sensor to shake off the adhered dust. This unique Canon system requires minimal space because a special filter is not necessary, allowing the camera's compact size to be maintained.
Is that really compact, though?
The self-cleaning sensor unit operates automatically whenever the power is turned on or off. But even when it is operating, priority shifts to shooting mode when you press the shutter button, so you never miss a photo opportunity. Furthermore, the application software that comes with the camera, Digital Photo Professional, has a dust delete function that is effective for any dust that may remain. Software processing makes the dust marks inconspicuous, preventing dust generation, preventing dust adhesion, and removing adhered dust. From APS-C to 35mm full frame, the EOS integrated cleaning system effectively solves the problem of sensor dust, regardless of sensor size. This is yet another illustration of Canon's commitment to the best possible digital photo quality.
Frankly, I don't remember that video being so embarrassing. It's really bad. But don't really listen to the marketing speak. Many other manufacturers have this now as well. So just because Canon says with that very dramatic movie voice, oh, you know, we have this system, it's great. Just about every other manufacturer has the same thing. But I'm still not convinced that you will be able to get away with using some sort of cleaning solution because you're just moving the dust elsewhere, like I said. And yes, certainly, so even if you're lazy and you don't want to clean the dust many times, you can resolve the dust issues on your photograph using software. So all I did here, I didn't take two photos exactly the same, one after cleaning the sensor and the other one not. I actually just used some software, and it's good enough for me. You can, if you look at the full resolution, you can see that there's some pot marks, so to speak, on the image itself, but it looks fine, I think. And so using software in almost every case is okay. So this is that same view of that camera, but the rear view, you can see the screen and some of the internal components. This side isn't perhaps as interesting because it's mostly buttons and some other doohickeys, but really, cameras have come a very, very long way in terms of how fast they are, how much data they can process. And just to give you a comparison, I did the math for my camera here, which is a 20D. It was released in late 2004. It has an 8-megapixel sensor. And they claim that it can take, you know, so many pictures per second, about six photos per second. And I compared it to this camera, the 40D, which was released 3 years later in 2007. Which has a larger sensor, it must be 10 megapixels, it looks like, 6.5 frames per second, variety of other things. And when you do the math, you realize that this 40D can process twice as much data in the same amount of time as the 20D. So just like computers, cameras are advancing at a rapid rate to be faster and to process more images. But that really doesn't mean that this camera is any worse than it was. So don't get tech lust. If you have to have the newest camera and you can afford it, then by all means go for it. But just because the 40D is twice as fast as my camera doesn't mean that I'm rushing out to buy it. So just be aware that technology is advancing and your camera will become obsolete, but just don't worry too much about it. So this seems like a good time to talk about just some of the little bit of the history behind digital cameras. So the first digital camera is pictured here, and it was created by an Eastman Kodak engineer called Steven Sasson in 1975. So it was a whopping 9 pounds, black and white only. It had 0.01 megapixels, and it took 23 seconds to capture a photo. So it really shows to the extreme how rapidly we are advancing this technology. It really is quite amazing. So just to give you an idea, 0.01 megapixels is 100 pixels wide by 100 pixels down, and that would be something like about this wide by about this tall on the screen. It's nothing at all. And later on, as digital cameras developed, Canon actually asked a designer to design some wacky SLRs. They wanted the SLR, the camera, to reflect the technology that was behind it. And so for some reason, they went to this sort of ocean theme with all of these fish and weird things. And frankly, it's sometimes embarrassing to be out in public with a camera and a large lens, but I would be far more embarrassed to be carrying one of these. It really is. I'm really glad that we didn't go this way, though they are interesting from an historical perspective, if nothing else. Okay, so that's it for history. I'm not a history guy myself, so I figure we'll go just a little bit deeper. Being a somewhat technical class, we do have to talk about bits, bytes, and some of the stuff that makes up these digital images that we are talking about. So hopefully this will be a review for some or most of you. But if it's not a bit, all it is, it's just a zero or a one. When we say one bit, it's just representing one of two values, zero or a one. And so that you might recognize this as being the language of computers, binary, and this is what we are talking about. So as you know, whenever we talk about megabits or kilobits or various other forms of measurement when relating to computers, we're talking about these things. And so a byte is 8 bits. So that means that we have 8 slots that can be either a zero or a one. So that means we have 8 slots that can be 2 different values. Right? So this means that you take 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, so on and so forth, 8 times, you get the number of different values that a byte can represent, which is 256. So whereas a bit represents 0 or 1, a byte is 8 bits and represents 256 values. And you might say, well, how did I come up with that? And I apologize, I know this will be difficult for those of you on the left side to see, but I will try to fix it in a minute. We have 8 slots here. Each can be 2 different values. So you do 2 times 2 times 2, so on and so forth. That's 2 to the 8th. That's 256 discrete values. Okay. So we could go into a lengthy discussion about how to convert decimal into binary, but it's really not necessary. So for those of you on the left side, hopefully you can see this now. 8 slots, 2 times 2. Times 2 times 2, so on and so forth. All you need to know are those things. So then we have, in addition to that, some extra things. So kilobytes, for example, are 1,024 bytes. Well, why isn't it 1,000 bytes? It's because we're measuring digitally. So it's actually 2 to the 10th equals 1024. It's not important why, but you can approximate it usually as 1,000. But that will sometimes get you into trouble, and we could go into a very lengthy discussion about why you shouldn't round. So anyway, kilobytes is 1,024 bytes. Megabytes is 1,024 kilobytes, or if you multiply 1,024 kilobytes by 1,024 bytes, you get 1,048,576, so on and so forth. So kilo is 1,000, mega is 1,000,000, giga is 1,000,000,000. Okay. Any questions on that? Good. So let's take a step back now and talk again about this photo. So what makes up a digital photo? How does it become what we see? If we are to zoom in a great amount, you can see that it is made up, it is composed of blocks. Lights are still too bright?
I'm not
getting
the contrast. It's
okay. Yeah, this is, I'm going to have to play with the lights a little bit. I'll play with them during the break. Okay, so I apologize for those of you watching the video at home. So, all right, so you can probably see at least some of the blocks that compose this image. And each block is called a pixel. So when we're talking about megapixels, we are talking about how many millions of pixels that a camera can use to make up an image. And don't let me go off. I hate the marketing scheme of using megapixels. I think it's complete crap, but we'll talk about that later. So realize that it's just made up of pixels. So you can tell that every pixel has its own color defined for it. So how is each color in each pixel defined? Well, we break it down into the complement into these basic colors that are used by computers, red, green, and blue. And each color value, red, green, and blue, so this is for one pixel, each color value has 8 bits of data associated with it. So the red channel has 256 different values that are associated with it. The green has 256 values associated with it, because remember, 8 bits is 1 byte, and I just spent a long time boring you about how a byte equals 256 values, and the same thing with blue. 8 bits equals 256 values. And so this may not sound like a lot. You may not be convinced that a photograph can only be made up of 256 different values, but you have to realize that you have to multiply these three together. So 256 times 256 times 256 to figure out how many different colors can actually be represented by this number. So that's 24 bits. So anybody happen to know? It's a lot. It's 16.7 million, I think, something like that. It's something ridiculously high. So you may not still be convinced. You may say, I want as much color information as I possibly can. So, well, let me take a step back first. So realize that we're talking here about JPEGs. So this is the most popular file type that you see on the internet, the .jpg files, as it's commonly referred to. Every pixel has these three values associated with it. So a JPEG is typically considered to be an 8-bit, or sometimes it will be called 24-bit, color. However, there are some file types where we can get more color than that. So for example, a 16-bit TIFF allows each color channel to have twice as many bits. So 16-bit of red by 16-bit green by 16-bit of blue. So this is 2 bytes. So you may think, well, we're only doubling the amount, but because it's 2 bytes, it's 2 to the 16th. This means that every channel, red and green and blue, each have 65,536 discrete possibilities of colors. So you multiply all that together, I don't know, it's 48 bits. It's ridiculously high. It is far more than you will probably ever need. But there are even further 32-bit values, and we'll probably talk about that at some future software lectures, so don't worry about that now. Generally, for just about every case, 8-bit should do you fine. We will talk about reasons why 16-bit is useful and why all of those different discrete values are useful. Okay, let's see. So just quickly, I want to talk very quickly about what's called compression. So when you are storing a file on your computer, it's usually not stored as every pixel, you know, as a sort of a map of every pixel with 3 different byte values. Those would be huge files. So JPEG compresses them in a certain way, and we're going to talk about one type of compression here, run length compression, run length encoding, where basically what they do, each of these images is 300 by 200 pixels, so it's 300 pixels wide by 200 pixels down. And the way this encoding works is it looks at the first pixel at the very top row, which would be what? In this left flag here. Yeah, black, right. So, and then it tries to figure out how many more columns or how many more pixels along the column or along that row are the same color. So it can go all the way across and figure out that all of the pixels are. So it will compress it and say, okay, for the next, from this pixel, for the next 300 pixels, we have the color black. And so already we've saved ourselves a great amount of information on the computer because we've reduced it basically by a factor of 300. So what about the French flag over here? Now we start at the first row. It says, okay, how many pixels can I go across with the color blue? Well, it can only go 100 pixels before it has to switch to white, before it has to switch to red. So when we're talking about this type of encoding, this sort of vertical stripes are not going to do it any favors. You will not be able to compress as well as something as this. So this is just one example of a type of encoding. There's many, 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 many other types. And in fact, most photographs, and dare say all photographs, are not encoded this way. Why might that be? Yeah, that's right, too many color changes. So even in a photo that looks like it doesn't have many color changes, so this may not be the best one, but whoops, too far. So right here in the center where it looks all white, there's very, very small changes in the color that, well, though you may not be able to detect while sitting down, looking at it on the screen or especially a computer can tell that it's one value off in maybe the green channel. And so suddenly it can't compress it using this method. So we have to be a little bit smarter about it. So this is just another example of a run length encoding. And you can see that now a photograph of an apple suddenly does not compress as well in this compression technique because it can only compress the background, essentially. So let's see. Okay. So let's take a look at how this might actually work in a photographic image. So this is an image of some rafters, and as you can tell, there's a lot of color changes. Tons and tons of colors in this. Everything, even along the water, every pixel is probably just a tiny bit different. The way that JPEG typically works is that it breaks it up into different blocks, and it tries to be smart about how each of those blocks should look. And so I'm not going to go into too much detail, but you can see on the right side, so both of this right side image and this left side image are zoomed in portions from that same portion up here in the upper left-hand corner. You can see what it looks like when you compress an image a lot in JPEG. So this is not what typically happens. I've overdone it. I've exaggerated it to show you how it works. But you can see that it's broken it up into blocks to try to figure out how it should do it. And it does this by a whole bunch of math, breaking up some of the channels and being a bit smart about it. But it does it a lot differently and a lot more with a much greater complexity than this run length encoding. So we'll probably reference this again, and this is just an example of why you should not, once you have a JPEG file, maybe you've taken it off your camera, maybe you've downloaded it off the internet, you should not resave it over itself as the same JPEG file over and over and over again. You'll eventually get this horrible blocking here. We'll discuss this more in future lectures. So just very quickly, just a rundown of some of the popular types of files that you will see. JPEG, of course, is the winner. We will almost always be looking at or working with JPEGs when we are discussing about images on the internet or on the computer. The compression is lossy, which is, I didn't explain in great detail, but when you start getting degradation of the image quality, even after saving the image a number of times, as you get here, that is considered to be a lossy file format. So while JPEG images look great and they're great because they do compress data very, very well, or they compress photographs very, very well, they're just like the equivalent of MP3s, where you can usually, after a while, start to hear some difference between something that's lossy compressed versus something versus the original. Yes?
I just trying to understand. So when it breaks up into blocks, is it making each block the same color, or is it more complicated than that?
It's more complicated than just trying to make each block the same color. It usually will look at these blocks and divide up the channel. So there's other color channels than what we were talking about. I was showing red, green, and blue, but there are other ones as well. And it tries to make assumptions about how our vision works and what we can notice. So they might make an assumption that this color contrast will be more noticeable than this color contrast. And therefore, the less noticeable one may simplify it as being one color, for example. But it can get to be quite complicated. So on the left here, we're looking at a blown-up image of a losslessly compressed file, or a file that was saved and not compressed, where nothing was done to it. So yes, it looks pixelated, where you can see each of the pixels, but there's no loss in the quality of this image. That's what differentiates between lossless and lossy. So we have GIF, which uses run-length encoding. It's actually, you will never use this. It's horrible. So remember that I said that the color is in JPEG 24 bits when you add up all three channels. GIF only has 8 bits for the entire image. So you only have 256 different values in the entire image. So it's not very good for photographs because there's obviously many more different values than just 256 discrete values. So now, just forget about GIF. It's really going to be useless for you from now on. Ping is pretty interesting. It compresses photographs losslessly, which means that unlike JPEG, it's not a lossy format. You won't get image degradation as you save it over time. And it also allows for what's called an alpha channel, which is basically transparency. We'll talk more about alpha channels later. But it's not very well supported across many browsers. And also because it's losslessly compressed versus lossy compressed, it is a much larger file. So JPEG still, if you need to send it over the internet, will be a better choice because it is much smaller than Ping. PSD is a Photoshop file. We'll be working with these a lot. It's a proprietary format, so I'm not really sure how it's compressed. I found some old data that said that it used run-length encoding for photos and other lossless techniques. But for now, I don't know what the most modern ones use. However, I do believe that they try to compress the image losslessly using some method that I'm just not sure. Notice that it says 48-bit color. That's just like TIFF, where each color channel can have 16 bits of color information each. So that means that TIFF and PSD, you can store a lot of color information, but the files are going to be monstrous. They're going to be huge. JPEG is good when you want to send it out over the internet or when you need to save the file to be relatively small. So when you're working with photos in Photoshop, you should almost always save it in the PSD format so that you can come back to it and be sure that every time you save it, you are not degrading the quality of your photograph. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break. Okay. Welcome back, everybody. So I was showing this table about different types of files, the JPEG, the GIF, and I realized that it may be a bit abstract to be talking about 24-bit versus 8-bit color. And so to really hammer this home, I don't have a lot of photos on this computer, but I took one that I have, and I converted it from a JPEG, a 24-bit JPEG, to an 8-bit GIF. And let me just reiterate that don't get confused, because when we talked about JPEG having 8 bits, we were talking about each of the three colors. Each of the three colors individually has 8 bits of information, making one pixel the sum value of that, or 24 bits of data, or rather, it's the product, but 24 bits of data. Whereas in the GIF file, the computer has to select only 256, or 8 bits worth of data, to select which colors to display. So here, this is an image. Look particularly closely near the sun and the gradient from the yellow sun towards the darker orange background. This is an 8-bit JPEG file. Now, if I were to bring up the 8-bit GIF, you can see we get what's called posterization. We'll talk about posterization much later, but you can see the steps that are involved, and that's because the computer had to pick some of the most popular colors and just stick with them. So this photograph, I would argue, actually converts to 8-bit better than most you will see, and that's because there's very few colors. It's mostly in the yellow to orange range. If we had a photograph that had many, many colors, so if I were to bring that rafting photograph, for example, it would really destroy it. But this one, we could probably get away with it, I don't like it. It looks terrible. Okay, any questions about file types?
How is it then that GIF is lossless?
GIF is lossless. Okay, that's a good point. So when we're talking about lossless versus lossy, we're not talking about the conversion that took place to get to it. We're talking about when it's saved on the computer. So if I were to take that GIF file, save it as a GIF file over itself, and just keep saving and saving and saving, it will always be compressed in the same way. But if I take that JPEG file and just keep saving it and saving it and saving it over itself, overwriting it so that all the bits change, we will slowly get this degradation of quality. And that's what I mean when I'm talking about lossless versus lossy. Not the conversion that I had to do between JPEG's 24-bit color to GIF's 8-bit color. Yes?
So you're talking about when you save as opposed to when you just save? Or does it also, if you...
So save as, when you do a save as and you save it as a different file type, you're usually performing some sort of conversion. So especially when there's a change in color. So if we go from maybe a 16 or 48-bit TIFF down to an 8 or a 24-bit JPEG, the computer has to do some conversion to make that 48 bits worth of data fit into 24 bits worth of data. When we're talking about lossless and lossy, we're not talking about that conversion that takes place between file types. Because between almost all of these, you will generally get some sort of lossy conversion. There are exceptions, but in just about every case, the exception would be PSD here. So when you are saving it into a container, a lossless container that has lots and lots of colors, you won't get any conversion problems. But that's beside the point. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is when you save, if you were to save the file over itself, which means that the computer, when you open it, has to uncompress it. Then when you save it onto itself, it has to recompress it. If it's lossless, the recompressed bits will be exactly the same as they were before. Whereas lossy, when you resave that file, it's going to change slightly, just ever so slightly, and eventually you will get a difference.
That's true then even if you change the file name.
So that's different. If you change the file name, you're just changing the file name. You're not changing the bits of the...
Save as with a different file name, it's still going to process it.
Yes, even if you do a save as. So you save as a different file, the new file will be recompressed, yeah, and it will have less quality than that old file.
That was a way around it, probably.
It's not a way around it, unfortunately.
Even if you set it at maximum quality?
Maximum quality, well, JPEG, no matter what, is lossy. Maximum quality will help prevent or slow down the process, but it's not going to stop it completely. So for those of you that have cameras that take photos only in JPEG format, when you download them onto your computer, this is my recommendation, make two copies. So I'm not talking about when you open it and then save as. That's not a copy. You're resaving the file. Download those photographs to two different locations on your computer and don't touch one of those locations. Leave it alone. That will be your original file, your baseline. If you ever mess up in any of your edits, you can go back to that original one, reopen it, and you will have that quality that you had originally. We'll talk more about this, though, in the next lecture when we talk about software. But now I just want to talk a little bit about some of the boring administrative stuff. So we have a number of lectures here, 14 different lectures, all on Monday, 7:35 to 9:35 p.m. We do have a number of breaks, like President's Day and spring break, and a lot of time for you guys to go out and play in the snow and spring break and such things. But this is generally the schedule, or this is the schedule for lectures. So coming up, we have software tools. Then after that, I think we get into the really, really fun stuff, light and exposure. That's where we take a step back from digital cameras and talk about photography in general. And we talk about how ISO affects f-number, aperture, all of these other things, shutter speed, and we really go into a lot of detail there. In fact, we go into so much detail that we have to take two lectures to do it. So lecture four, then, is exposure continued. Lecture five, we talk about lenses, optics in general. Lecture six, the histogram. Which, frankly, sounds like it's not going to be a very long lecture, but just you wait to see what I have in store for you guys then. Software tools, so we will talk more about editing, whereas next week will be more, will be some preliminary edits, but also very generally just to bring everybody to the same, level, how to download photographs, etc. Assignment slideshow. And so these assignment slideshows are actually fairly interesting. So in the course, we have, as part of the expectations, that you attend all of the lectures, you complete 4 assignments. There's 1 final project at the end. There's no exams. So we have 4 assignments. So after 2 assignments are completed, part of those will be you actually taking photographs. We, the staff, will compile photographs, and more details about this forthcoming. We'll compile photographs and spend an hour looking at them, talking about them. And don't worry too much. Nobody is going to laugh at you or think poorly of you for any photographs that you take. I guarantee it. Most of the time, and what I noticed last year, is that everybody has something constructive to say, and at the very least, everybody is interested in how that photograph was taken. And that's what this is for, is to try to talk to each other and get new ideas about how photographs are taken, what sort of ideas you used to accomplish a photograph, and just to have a good old time. That's also, we'll also have a short 1-hour movie-like thing on Lecture 8. Lecture 9 and 10, digital cameras, where we go into more detail about the sensors and how digital cameras record light and some of the specifics there. Lecture 11 is interesting. It's all about color. And you may think that we've covered quite a bit of detail with this 8 bits, but we haven't even started scratching the surface. It gets really, really complicated. And if you've ever opened up Photoshop and gone to the color settings and been blown away by how much you don't know about that window, we will talk about many of those things. Lecture 12, artifacts. We actually already went over one of these called posterization, when you decrease the number of available colors and you start seeing this banding. We have more examples of artifacts then. Even more software tools, where we talk about lots of, we talk about some even fancier edits that you can do to your photographs. And finally, Lecture 14 is the assignment slideshow 2. So there is something a little bit different about the final project. So final project, you will, it's really basically the idea is to go out and make one. Of course, we'll have a lot more details later, but some of the stuff that came out last year of having so much creativity is just immense. It really is impressive what people can come up with when you're not given any guidance about what you should have a final project about. So start thinking about what you want to do. Of course, it should be photographically based, and we will talk more about this much, much later. But there is an additional final project. So just like we have the assignment slideshows in various lectures, we will actually join forces with Computer Science E75 Building Dynamic Websites, and we'll have this sort of computer science fair where you will have completed your final project by then, and you can show off your work to these dorkier folks that, dare I say, unless any of them are here, that have built their own dynamic website. And so it will be a fun place for you to eat cake, meet your peers, talk about your photographs, and generally just have a good time. That will be on May 18th. All of this information, though, is on the course website, which is very simply cse7.org. We have the syllabus there. We'll have a lot more information. I might as well show it to you. Let's see. So you, hopefully most of you have been to it already, and you'll notice that we have a variety of things along the left side. Assignments will be posted. Not only will they be given out in lecture, but they'll be posted as PDFs online. List of lectures, some of the resources, which we'll slowly fill out as the term progresses. Sections will be announced on the website and next week in lecture, and the syllabus. But there's some other fun stuff, too. And you'll notice that many of you may realize that this is not the same photo that you saw last time you visited the website. And indeed, we have this concept of themes, where there are many photos that can happen on this website. So if you don't like a theme, you can click on the image at the top, and it changes the theme. Now, a few assignments from now, you will actually be creating a theme for the website. That includes the photograph, but also the color scheme. More details of that, of course, will be coming up. Okay, so you may have noticed that my email address was on the staff or on the course website. You're free to email me directly. You're free to email any of the staff directly. But the best way to email us is to email the staff list, staff@cse7.org. This will be sent to all of us, Chris, John, and myself. And whoever can get to your email first will respond to it. So this will ensure that you get the fastest response possible. So you, like I said, you are free to email us directly. There will probably be a staff page going up later with their contact information. Okay, so there is another way to get help as well. So besides emailing us for questions, I ask that those of you that have more general questions, so something that's not very specific about like, oh, what is my grade or something specific like that, we are announcing the CSE7 forum where basically you can log in and we have all of your email addresses, so we will create logins for you. You will be emailed a username and password for this forum. You are invited, beginning as soon as you get your login, you are invited to log in and post questions about lecture questions. So I'll try to increase the font size here. We will have announcements here, lecture questions. You can ask general questions. And of course, we have a section devoted to photography, cameras specifically. Editing, uploading, photo tips, photo critiques. And the way that this works, so you are allowed to upload a photograph. So I'll go ahead and just demo one. So let's say I want to get a photo critique on one of my photographs. You click on one of these boards, you click on a new topic, and you can say, what do y'all think of my awesome, I can't spell when I can't see what I'm typing, awesome photograph. And then you can write something in the body. Your grade depends on it. Now, this is the tricky part. So there are a couple of ways to do it. Let's say you have an image up on Flickr, for example, or some social website, and you want your E7 friends and peers to take a look at it. You can use the image tag, which is, it's really difficult to see, but it's this one here. No, that's insert hyperlink. It's this frame-looking thing. I'll try to zoom in. You see it underneath the italics. You can click on that, and you can type in the URL of some image. But the better way, I think, to do this is to actually attach an image, much like you would attach an image to an email. So at the very bottom of this posting, there's a place for you to attach an image. You can click Browse, and you can go to your Pictures folder, include this picture, click Open, and click Preview. Okay, so now, I clicked Post instead of Preview. Preview will allow you to preview your post before you do it to make sure you didn't make any typical internet spelling mistakes. So now you can see that I have my thing here. Now this is the cool thing about attaching it rather than using the image tag. It shows you some data about the image itself. So in the upcoming lectures, we'll decode all of this data. We'll talk about what all of it means, but you can see how I took this image. It shows the shutter speed, the ISO, the aperture, the exposure compensation, and the focal length that I used, whether or not I used flash, when it was taken, so on and so forth. So this is pretty cool, and I hope that most of you will take part in it. And certainly, we do have, besides that, some additional boards on assignments, if you have questions about assignments. Now, this is the thing that I ask you not to do, please. You are allowed to post photographs on it, but if you post a photograph in the assignment section, do not submit that same photograph for the assignment itself. Because the idea is that if you take a look at our academic dishonesty policy, it's strictly prohibited there. But so it's the same sort of thing carries on here. If you're free to show a photograph here, but if you really like it and you think you might use it in assignment, the thing is just don't post it here. So the easiest thing to do might be to just ask questions in these assignments sections and not necessarily post photos and say, oh, do you think I'll get an A with this photo or something like that? Is that clear? Okay, so that's it. This, I hope, will be a fun way for all of us to socialize about photographs and to talk about the different photography techniques and camera systems and various other things that we have. Okay, so for those of you that have registered for the course and are doing it for credits, you'll notice that you do not actually need a camera to complete the assignments in this course. And that is true. You do not need to purchase one. We have some available through the Church Street Lab, and they are these Panasonic Lumix cameras. And it looks pretty small, but it packs a pretty good punch. It's a compact camera. It's not an SLR, so you can't remove the lens. And details about how to rent them are forthcoming. But essentially what you're going to do, we'll go down to the Church Street lab on 53 Church Street. We'll put this information up on the forum as well, so don't worry too much about it. You tell them that you're with E7, and you ask to rent out one of the Panasonic cameras, and they will give you one of these. Make sure that when you get this camera, you also get the charger and the USB cable to plug in the camera, because it would really be a shame if you took a lot of amazing photos and had to return it without downloading the photos to your computer. So make sure that you get those three things. And these are pretty good cameras. They are, being compact cameras, they have the same advantages and disadvantages as other compact cameras. So they're not as fast as SLRs, for example, but it is small and it's very light. And it also has a great number of features. You can take raw photographs, for example, and that will be very important in just a few weeks' time. And also you can set the exposure manually using a manual exposure mode, which is also very important for the assignments. If you do have a camera of your own, those are the two requirements that it must meet for you to be able to use it for this course. Initially, for the first few photographs that you take for the assignment, you don't have to worry about it. Don't worry about if your camera has the manual mode, but eventually you will have to check out one of these cameras to complete the assignments, because you'll have to be setting exposure settings manually, and you'll have to be taking some photographs in the raw format. And yes, we check. We can check, as you saw in that, the website knows what information your camera used to create the image. The same way we will know if you have followed our directions or not. So please do be mindful of that information. You can, of course, if you have your own, you're more than welcome to bring them to class, ask specific questions about them, especially to section. We will try our best, though we are all familiar with our own types of cameras, we will certainly do our best to help generalize it and talk to you about each of the features of your own specific cameras. Okay, so just very quickly, I thought I would make a comparison about this course to film. So some of you may be coming into this course with only a background in film photography. So you may have taken thousands of rolls of film or hundreds of thousands of rolls of film, if you have the money for it, and are now wanting to enter into the digital photography market. And next week will especially be helpful for you, where we bring everyone up to the same level of downloading the images to your computer. We'll talk about that very briefly. But also, you'll be very comfortable here if you're familiar mostly with film, because a lot of the things in the digital photography world carry over from the film photography world. A lot of the same terminology is used. The SLRs look almost exactly the same. They behave almost exactly the same. So you should feel very, very comfortable. The only thing that you may not feel comfortable with is opening Photoshop for the first time and realizing just what a mess that it can be. So don't worry if you are here wondering if you should stay in this class because you're familiar only with film. I say stay. Man, I practiced that one too. No, I'm kidding. So I say stay, and you're more than welcome. We will, of course, do our best to point out the differences where something might be different from the film world to the digital world. Okay, so being a primarily technical class, and realize that the idea is that we are going to be technically minded, like I said earlier, so that when you pick up a camera and you're in a situation where you can take a photograph, you know what to do. You can do it quickly, you know how the camera will behave, and you can worry about the artistic aspect of the photograph later, when you're actually there. We will talk about artistic things in this course, so I'm not going to completely discount it and say, okay, yeah, you know, you guys can be all artsy that you want, but we're not going to talk about it here. There are some things that you can do to generally improve your images. And the very first thing is to stop centering everything. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of seeing people's faces right in the center with a big dorky smile. Big dorky smile is fine. Just move it to the side a little bit. And there is this idea called the rule of thirds, and everybody talks about it. The rule of thirds this, the rule of thirds that. The idea is that you divide the frame of your image into three different sections, horizontally and vertically. So now you have a grid of 9 different spaces, and you should try to aim to put subjects of your photograph in various spaces or even along the lines themselves. And you'll notice that here in this photograph, when I took this photograph while rafting, I really didn't intend to do this, but it matches up fairly well with this rule of thirds, where we have big water splash on this left-hand side third, and the right third we have a person fairly evenly lined up with it. So even if you're just taking a photograph of one subject, so maybe it's an apple sitting on a table, one of your friends sitting in a bar, what have you, try different things. We're all very used to seeing each other and seeing the world by centering on it, by looking at each other with them in the center of our vision, by looking at it from, you know, 4.5 to 6.5 feet tall on average. So try different things. Not only should you try moving your camera around to place things on different angles or on different sections of the photograph, try placing the camera at a slightly different angle. And so sometimes people go crazy with this and they do, you know, exactly 45 degrees and it's almost nauseating, but sometimes it can be very tastefully done when you need to put the camera at an angle in order to get more into the shot. Try taking photographs from the ground, from above your head. This photograph that I took before, you'll notice that it's at eye level. This was perhaps the worst thing that I possibly could have done, but it's the only way in this case that I could get the most amount of people in the photo at once. It would have been a lot more interesting maybe from up there in the corner, where we could have made it look like a security camera type of photograph, or maybe down from the floor where, well, we would see a lot of feet, but that's not the goal in that case. But the point is that by moving the camera around, by trying different things, you will instantaneously, just by trying it, be making your photos a lot more interesting. And this is something that I actually battled with for a long time. And in fact, I became very disillusioned by photography in a way, because I didn't know, or I just could not make photos interesting, or I didn't think that when I took a photo that it became interesting. And it seems to me that the reason that that ended up happening was because, sure, I was following my own advice. I was taking things from different angles. I was placing the camera at different elevations. But what happened was that the subject just ended up feeling very, very familiar to me. So I can only take so many pictures of my home or my car, for example, before I just start getting bored of it. And so something that many of us just don't have the luxury to do is to take photographs in interesting places. And this is not going to count against you if you can't go to Africa, for example, and take photographs of things that none of us have ever seen before. But it's something that you should strive to do, not only in this class, even though you won't be great in it, but every time you take a photograph is, how can I make a standard situation, even my buddies sitting around a table in a bar, or just bunch of folks sitting down in a classroom, how can I try to make this photograph more interesting? And so we can run into this dialogue about how you should try to focus on what the subject of your photograph is. Do you really want to capture your friend smiling on the right of you, or your friend smiling with milk coming out of his nose on the left of you? And timing really seems to be everything in photography. So it's a lot of skill that you need. It's a lot of timing, and it's a lot of luck. It's just dumb luck sometimes that you get a photograph that looks as good as it does because you happen to capture something at the exact moment that it is correct. And many of us, well, some of us will be better than others at it, and that's perfectly okay. I don't think that I do a very good job with timing. So when I take a photograph of someone, I'm not sure that I capture that person's smile at just the right time, when that smile, when looking at it in a photograph, means the most or has the most impact. So this was lucky. I took a lot of photographs that trip, and I'm showing you just one of them. I did take some others that I was proud of, but eventually you can learn timing as well, especially in this sort of situation. Even though it looks like I was on the water, I was sitting on a rock watching some people going by until I recognized this boat as being ours, and then I knew when to take the photograph. And so not only is it luck, like I said, but skill as well. So don't blame your lack of photographic skill or complete experience on luck, because you really can get lucky sometimes, and most of the time, especially at the end of this course, you will have the skills to do it correctly. So just focus on what is interesting to you, even if you don't have the funds or the willpower to go to some faraway land to take some very strange and unusual photographs. Use the skills that you've learned to take a photograph that would be interesting to someone else. And that's really the key, I think, here, is trying to figure out what is interesting to other people, who your audience is, and various other things. And this really, I'm really starting to sound like I'm talking about a lot of generalizations, but it's really hard to name specifics just because there are so many different ways of taking photographs, so many different timings that's possible when taking a photograph. So generally the idea with the rule of thirds, so come off that very long tangent, is that you want to draw the eye in some particular direction. And so this perhaps is not the best photograph to be an example of drawing the eye, but sometimes maybe you will take a photograph very close to the ground of a road. And the idea there is that you're drawing the eye from, you know, the road that's closest to you, the aspect of the road that's closest to you, to the farthest point away. And so when we're talking about drawing the eye, it's like giving a little bit of motion in a way, or some animation to a still photograph. So one way to capture that is by drawing the eye. Another way to do that is to try to stop time. And so here, if we were to look at the original image, one of the things that I really like about this image is that you can see individual water droplets glistening as it flies through the air. And that becomes very interesting, I think. So that is another thing to consider, is do you want to draw the eye by using some sort of geometric shape, by using a road to flow your eye in some particular direction? Or do you want to draw the eye more generally by capturing some specific moment? And so when you're considering these things, you can figure out what type of shutter speed you want to use, for example, because this would look very, very different had I used a much slower shutter speed where the water suddenly becomes very smooth, very milky, rather than somewhat harsh in this case. So there are many more tips, of course, that I'm sure many of you are wanting to share, especially when it comes to composition, when it comes to balancing color, drawing the eye, many of these things. It's part of what the forum is for. And we'll try to talk about them in the upcoming lectures. And like I said earlier before, one of the things that we will try to touch on a reasonable amount this semester is how to save some money, because photography is a grossly expensive hobby. You can buy an SLR and say, oh yeah, I'm moving up in the world, I bought an SLR, but now all of a sudden you have to buy lenses that cost 2-3 times the amount of the SLR by themselves, and all the little doohickeys here, like cables and adapters and filters and all sorts of little things that you really think you need, and eventually you realize that you never really use them, like this little thing. And so part of this will be, we're not going to have a very large focus on it, but whenever we can, if you ever have a do-it-yourself sort of thought during a lecture, do feel free to interject and say, oh, hey, well, we can do that. Sure, we can buy, you know, a $100 piece of equipment to do that, but can't we also do this to accomplish that same goal? That sort of stuff is very much welcome here. And though I am talking about, or I'm preaching saving money, I must say that if you're interested in digital photography at all, you must get a tripod. There's no question about it. You must get a tripod, because that by itself will really increase the quality of your photographs. It really doesn't matter what kind of camera you have. And so this tripod that I have here is really a bit heavy, and it's frankly a bit overkill for many of the tasks that I need. But a big, heavy tripod is much more versatile than a light $20 plastic tripod, which will eventually break. And as I found out the hard way, the light tripods just tend to shake a lot in the wind. And so if you can weigh down your tripod, so even if you don't have a very expensive tripod, you can usually try to weigh it down. So maybe you have your camera bag with you, wrap it around the center strap and give it some additional weight, or pull on your tripod to give it some additional weight. You'll balance it more, you'll stabilize it more, so that you can get crisper, cleaner shots. But I'm very much an advocate of getting a very good tripod. And even though I would say that I have missed shots that I regret because this tripod is too big for most of my luggage. So it's obviously not collapsed right now, but when it's collapsed, it's just ever so slightly too big. And that's another consideration to take into account when we're talking about all of these things. Sure, having an SLR that's big and expensive is great, but what's the point if you can't take the photograph? So in that case, is it better to have a smaller camera where you can take the photograph? And having that photograph is better than not having it at all, even though you have better equipment for the task, if that makes sense. And there's actually something that's fairly interesting that I saw recently that's very do-it-yourself. And that's not it. So here, someone had posted instructions online about how to make a panoramic tripod head. So realize that when we talk about tripods, most of the ones that you buy in like Best Buy or the now defunct Circuit City are one unit. But most tripods, or most of the, it's probably the wrong word, but most of the better tripods, or the more expensive tripods at least, come in two parts, where it's the legs by themselves and the head up here that you attach. And so this head is specific for photography. It's not very well suited for video tasks, for example, for a variety of reasons. But I chose this combination because of the weight and because of the head. And so you can mix and match. And so what this guy did is it's an example of removing the head off of these tripod legs and creating a new head for panoramic shots for about $10, where normally these panoramic heads can cost hundreds of dollars or more for very, very expensive ones. And this, again, is not only advocating do-it-yourself, but that sort of same issue of getting the photograph or not getting it at all. And so if you're interested in this sort of thing, I'll post this online. And certainly if you have any additional do-it-yourself links or fun photography tips, do feel free to post on the forum. But for now, that's about it. I hope to see you all again next week, and thank you all for coming.